morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Weber v. Universities Research Association. Mr. Baker.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Robert Baker, and I represent the appellant, Catherine Weber, who was employed by the defendant as a professional engineer for over 18 years until the events at issue in this lawsuit ended her career. At the heart of this appeal are two erroneous conclusions reached by the district court in granting summary judgment on Ms. Weber's claims of retaliation and gender discrimination. First, the district court erred in concluding that Ms. Weber could not establish a prima facie case of retaliation or gender discrimination. Second, the district court erred in concluding that Ms. Weber had not established pretext. There was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether the defendant acted with retaliatory and discriminatory motivation in demoting and subsequently terminating Ms. Weber, and whether the stated reasons for her treatment were pretextual. The following issue should be resolved by a finder of fact. Was Ms. Weber demoted and eventually terminated following her complaints of discrimination because she was a female employee who was making trouble, or was it because, as the defendant says, she was violating company policies, which were not being applied equally to similarly situated male employees? There are numerous facts that establish retaliation and discrimination. In 1991, Ms. Weber was a victim of gender discrimination when sexual comments were written about her on a bulletin board and condoms and jock straps were placed in her office. At the time, a coworker, Fritz Lang, a gentleman whom this court will hear me refer to often this morning, told her she should just make a joke of it. However, the perpetrators were never identified, and she was transferred to a different department within the defendant's accelerator division. In 1996, over her objection, she was transferred back into the same department where the harassment had occurred. Fritz Lang, who is now the head of the department, told Ms. Weber, "I want you to be good because I don't want any trouble in my department." She took the position as a leader of a computerized data storage system known as the CMMS project. In the fall of 2003, she received an adverse performance review completed in violation of company policy by Fritz Lang and her immediate supervisor, a gentleman named Dave Augustine. In December of 2003, she filed a claim of discrimination against Augustine with the defendant's Equal Employment Office. The compliance officer, a woman named Diane Ingram, considered this to be a formal complaint of discrimination and investigated the complaint by speaking to Augustine and the associate head of the division, Paul Zarapata. But because the compliance officer was not getting anywhere with these gentlemen, she told Ms. Weber to file a formal grievance with the head of the accelerator division. Unfortunately, the defendant refused this grievance and told her she needed to grieve with her immediate supervisor, Dave Augustine. Now, this was contrary to the defendant's grievance procedures, which permitted a person to file a complaint with the head of the division if his or her claim was with the immediate supervisor. In January 2004, it became clear that the company was not going to let her grieve her complaint with the head of the division, so reluctantly she filed the complaint, or filed the grievance, excuse me, with Mr. Augustine. Also in January of 2004, while the company is supposedly addressing her grievance, Fritz Lang, the same gentleman I've been speaking about, approached Mr. Zarapata about eliminating the project Ms. Weber was working on. Also during the pending grievance, the company's HR department is taking steps to figure out if they can terminate Ms. Weber in exchange for a severance package that could be used to obtain a release of potential claims against the company. This is all going on immediately after complaint while her grievance is still pending. When the company learned that it did not have permission to terminate Ms. Weber, it began to take efforts to confirm that the CMMS project was not a viable project that could justify eliminating her position. These activities were all going on while Weber believed the company was addressing her complaint. And it's important to note that the individuals who were the subject of the initial evaluation that she claimed was discriminatory, Mr. Augustine and Mr. Lang, were also involved in the decision to terminate her position, the resolution of her grievance, and the company's efforts to obtain a waiver of potential claims against it. Ms. Weber's claim eventually was resolved in February of 2004, but 3 weeks later, she learned that her position was being eliminated, and if she wanted to stay employed with the company, she had to take one of two positions, both of which were a demotion from her current position.
Well, I've got a little trouble with that, Mr. Baker. The position she took, how is that a demotion? The compensation is the same. She's an engineer, too. The duties are different. She's under some closer supervision than she was in this other position. But how is it a demotion?
Well, there's several factors and several pieces of evidence that we believe support that it was a demotion, not necessarily in title, but in stature and in responsibility. First, she was previously a team leader, within this department. The position she took under Ms. Adder was two levels below. So that's a demotion in the hierarchy amongst this part of the division.
Well, second, it doesn't sound like she really had a lot of responsibilities in that CMS project. It seemed to be just sort of floating along on its own.
Well, I think that the record is she did have some responsibility, and certainly her title was a group leader. And even before she was a CMS group leader, since 1986, she had been an engineer, too, and held other group leader positions. So this is going back almost 18 years, where she had consistently held a group leader title, an engineer, too, and now she's working for a more junior engineer, who had recently moved from an engineer 1 to an engineer 2 just before she became the supervisor of Ms. Weber. She begins monitoring Ms. Weber, applying different circumstances when she can take sick leave. They move her office from an area where there were other engineers to an area referred to as the garage. And you have Fritz Lang, the same gentleman, requesting that he's being blind copied on communications between Weber and her immediate supervisor. This is all going on as part of this demotion. So while her compensation remained, the stature and her level within the company and her responsibilities were all different. Well, after her demotion, as I said, things simply got worse for her working for Ms. Weber. She complained again to the EEO department about the circumstances she was now working for under Ms. Adder. And instead of addressing these issues, the company, in May of 2004, traces Ms. Weber's computer. Shortly thereafter, Mr. Lang advised Ms. Weber that he was recommending that she be terminated based upon a review of her computer traffic, which showed she had been using her computer to support a private business and had not provided notice to the company of that business. Defendants have argued that the termination was for legitimate reasons. But this explanation has been rebutted by evidence that the policies she was supposedly violating were not equally applied to similarly situated male employees within this division. First, Mr. Zarapata, the associate head of the division, testified that there was a male employee in the accelerator division who was caught viewing pornography, and he received what Mr. Zarapata referred to as the standard punishment, a warning letter. Ms. Weber was terminated for viewing dog training websites.
Well, it had to do with her business, didn't it?
Well, Your Honor, there were two reasons. And the second reason was she had not provided notice of this outside business, this dog training business. But Ms. Weber testified during her deposition that there were several male employees in the accelerator division who also, like her, had an outside employment. And the company actually monitored some of these gentlemen and discovered that at least four of them did in fact have an outside business, and at least two of them had not filed the same notice that Ms. Weber had supposedly not filed with the company, and that was the reason she was terminated. So not only is the computer policy not being applied to other similarly situated males, but so too is the outside employment. So both of these reasons we believe are pretextual.
But the computer usage that Ms. Weber was involved with was pretty substantial, wasn't it? Over 4 or 5 days, 15 or 16 hours worth of work time devoted to being out there on the internet doing things in connection with her side business. And none of the others had any involvement that measured to that extent.
Well, Your Honor, that is a good point. However, the amount of time that Ms. Weber spent on the computer was not determined until afterwards, and there's no evidence in the record that that was a factor that was considered in terminating her. And in fact, if you look at the recommendation for her termination and her subsequent termination letter, neither of those documents indicate that it's the frequency of your use that we have a problem with, Ms. Weber. It's the fact that you didn't tell us about your company and you were using the computer to support it. And in fact, during the deposition, many of the individuals who were involved in the decision to terminate Ms. Weber, none of them could testify as to how long she had been actually on the computer. The only individual who gave any testimony really as to the amount of time was Christine Adder, her immediate supervisor, who said it was significant. But when you take that statement, you have to read her entire testimony. She says, well, the computer traffic appeared significant. However, I don't know how much time it was. You would need an expert to look at that. You need a computer person. Well, after the lawsuit was filed, the defendants had an IT person look at it and determine that it was a significant amount of time and filed an affidavit that said it was 16 hours. But then again, this is not a distinguishing factor between Ms. Weber and these other gentlemen because there's absolutely no evidence that the amount of time was even considered in her termination. Now, with respect to her retaliation claim, under the direct method, we believe there is a causal connection between her complaint of discrimination in December of 2003 and her subsequent demotion and termination, from which a finder of fact could infer a connection between these two events. First, the timing is suspicious, and the timeline is this. Weber filed a complaint with the EEO in December of 2003. Within a few weeks following this complaint, the company begins considering eliminating her position or, in the alternative, terminating her and obtaining a release of claims against her. This is in the weeks right after her complaint.
You're into your rebuttal time, you know.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Under the indirect method, also her discrimination claim, we believe we've established a prima facie case of retaliation because the evidence of the unequal application of these policies creates an inference of discrimination. It also creates evidence of pretext, and we believe both of these claims should be presented to a finder of fact so that the motivation of the defendant can be analyzed as such. And I will reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Osgood.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Ms. Osgood, and I represent the appellee in this matter. Your Honors, notwithstanding the 60-page opening brief and certainly voluminous record on appeal, this is actually a very simple case that boils down to a few simple facts that are not disputed and are material. First, Ms. Weber's position was eliminated by the appellee in February of 2004. At this time, she could have been terminated, but instead was offered a choice between two positions. Ms. Weber then chose to return to an engineering position with the same pay, benefits, and title to a job that she had previously held. Between March and May of 2004, her supervisor, Ms. Ader, recognized that while Ms. Weber was spending a great deal of time at her computer, she was not very productive. She therefore conferred with Paul Zarapata, the department head, about what she had noticed, and Mr. Zarapata suggested that they place a computer trace to determine what she exactly was doing, which traced her internet activity. The internet trace showed, and plaintiff does not dispute, that she spent 16.25, or roughly 40% of one, or 16.25 hours, or roughly 40% of one work week, cruising the internet, viewing non-work-related websites, specifically dog-related websites, and opening her personal email accounts. When confronted with these findings by Ms. Frazier of the Human Resources Department and by Ms. Ader, Ms. Weber admitted that she was aware of URA's computing policy and that she had an outside business named Canine Pedicate, which involved dog training. She further admitted that the email accounts belonged to her, that she visited the email accounts, that she visited many of the websites, including many of the dog-related websites, and that she had not submitted an outside work authorization form, which was in violation of URE's policies. Based on these internet traces, Ms. Ader conducted her own research and found three pieces of literature, which could arguably be construed as advertisements, which listed these same email accounts as Ms. Weber's contact information for her business. She also found a roster of certified pet trainers, which listed Ms. Weber's work telephone number as the contact information. Now, keep in mind that this business, Canine Petticoat, at the time of Ms. Weber's termination in 2004, had been listed on Ms. Weber's tax returns as a sole proprietorship since 2002. Between 2002 and 2004, she had reported over $40,000 in revenues, over $141,000 in expenses, including expenses related to selling merchandise through her business, as well as costs associated with attending dog shows every week. She also leased a facility that was more than 2,500 square feet, for which she paid over $2,500 a month in a lease in order to operate her business. At this time, Roger Dixon decided to terminate Ms. Weber's employment based on all of these undisputed facts.
Well, your opposing counsel indicates that there were male employees who had, if not exactly the same, some involvement with computers unrelated to business as well. How do you respond to that?
Well, actually, Your Honor, the record does not support his assertions. What Ms. Weber alleged in her deposition and as well as in her response to the request to terminate her employment was that there were other male individuals who worked for Fermilab who had outside businesses. These allegations were investigated, and it was found that and a computer trace was actually placed on most of these individuals' computers, and it was found that none of them were engaging in outside business activities while at work, nor were any of them using their computers in conjunction with their businesses. Moreover, it is undisputed that Fermilab has terminated no less than three individuals for conducting work related to a personal business on URE time, two of whom were men and none of whom engaged in statutorily protected activity. I would also add that the individuals that Ms. Weber identified, she has provided absolutely no facts as to whether or not these people engaged in statutorily protected activity.
Let me ask you something unrelated necessarily to that. The defendant in this case was Universities Research Association, and they're a contractor of Fermilab, or how does this? What's the relationship between Fermilab itself and this?
My apologies, Your Honor. Actually, Universities Research Association Incorporated is also known as Fermilab, which is the physical location where the research is conducted. They are, in fact, a government employer and are one in the same. Or not a government employer, a government contractor. Ms. Weber's claim fails for additional reasons. First, she did not engage in statutorily protected activity. Ms. Weber's retaliation claim hinges on a grievance that she filed in December of 2003. She admitted in her statement of facts, particularly in response to defendant statements 24 and 25, which can be found on page 50 of defendant's supplemental appendix to its initial submission to this court on December 30, 2008, that she does not mention sex discrimination or that she was singled out on the basis of her sex in this grievance. Instead, she generally complains about goals that were set for her, the type of goals that were set for her, and that she disagreed that anyone had complained about her performance. At the end, she asked that Fermilab remove this performance evaluation from her file. It is very clear under this circuit's holdings that a plaintiff must indicate that gender was at issue in order to be considered protected activity. That Ms. Weber first went to Ms. Engram with the Equal Employment Opportunity Office is of no import in this case. To begin with, Ms. Weber does not remember what she said to Ms. Engram when she went to speak about the performance evaluation.
Didn't Engram treat it as though it was a gender-based complaint?
No, she did not, Your Honor. She testified that Fermilab has an open-door policy that she has been employed by Fermilab as of in 2004 for 20 years, that she had worn many hats within the Human Resources Department, and that it was not at all uncommon for individuals to come to her with all sorts of workplace complaints, some of which were related to protected activity or protected statuses, some of which were just generalized complaints, and that it was her job to answer and handle all of these complaints, which is what she did with Ms. Weber.
Well, when she was asked about opening files or having files, didn't she say she had a file on Ms. Weber from 91, those gender complaints, and then this new file?
Yes, Your Honor. She did testify that she initially opened up a file for Ms. Weber in 1991. But the testimony that's offered in support that this somehow establishes that Ms. Weber made a complaint of discrimination or that Ms. Engram treated it as such is really misguided. Initially, Ms. Engram was asked if she opens files when someone comes to her to complain of discrimination. She answered yes. Later on in her deposition, she was asked if she ever supplements those files. She answered yes if employees come to talk to me later. In this instance, Ms. Engram specifically testified that notwithstanding the fact that she did not consider Ms. Weber's complaint to be that of discrimination, she nonetheless supplemented the file in order to keep all the papers and facts straight.
Well, the resolution of that complaint took a much longer time than the guidelines for such things at that URA. Is that right?
Your Honor, it did, but...
Isn't that suspicious?
It is not suspicious when you look at the underlying facts associated with the delay in resolving this grievance. Ms. Weber testified that she first went to Ms. Engram in November of 2003 to complain about the manner in which her performance evaluation had been conducted. On December 10th, she filed her first grievance, a level 2 grievance with Roger Dixon. On December 11th, Mr. Zarapata responded on behalf of Mr. Dixon, instructing her to file a level 1 grievance with her supervisor. On January 5th, Ms. Weber responded to Mr. Zarapata, saying that she disagreed with his assessment that she had to file a level 1 grievance and that she could proceed directly to a level 2 grievance. On January 7th, Mr. Zarapata again responded to her, saying that he had conferred with Juanita Frazier of the Human Resources Department and that in this instance, because her grievance revolved around a performance evaluation, that she should, in fact, file a level 1 grievance with her supervisor. Ms. Weber then waited until January 16th to file the grievance with her supervisor, Mr. Augustine, and at that time, Mr. Augustine had 10 working days, according to the policy, to resolve the grievance. And it was resolved within that time by February 2nd when she was notified that the grievance was sustained.
At the level 1 grievance.
At the level 1 grievance, that the grievance had been sustained and that the performance evaluation would be removed from her file. That Ms. Engram spoke to Paul Zarapata or David Augustine is also of no importance, since Ms. Engram testified that she merely wanted to inform them that from a human resources perspective, she felt that the performance evaluation had not been conducted correctly and that they had not first set goals for Ms. Weber before conducting the performance evaluation. Paul Zarapata supported this understanding of the conversation he had with her by stating that he was not aware at the time that David Augustine was part of any retaliation or discrimination investigation, but rather just the manner in which a performance evaluation was conducted. And this can be found at page 34 of Mr. Zarapata's deposition. The discontinuation of the CMMS project was not an adverse employment action. And in any event, this argument is waived as it was not raised before the district court. On pages 85 through 88 of the supplemental appendix that the appellees filed on December 30th, it is clear that Ms. Weber only argued that her discipline and earlier transfers prior to 2004 constituted the basis of her claim. Notwithstanding this fact, as Your Honors have correctly noted, the transfer to the engineering position was hardly a demotion. In fact, on page 86 of the supplemental appendix, Ms. Weber argued before the district court that not being an engineer and, in fact, becoming a member of the CMMS project was the demotion. She's hard-pressed to now change her tune and establish that the engineering duties were somehow inferior or that they limited her prospects for a promotion, which is the crux of any determination in regards to an adverse employment action, especially in light of the fact that the CMMS project had been discontinued and she was the only employee assigned to it. Clearly, there was no opportunity for advancement for her in her old position. That she went from a group leader back to an engineer is also not dispositive, and the court should refer to Flaherty versus Gas Research, which is actually a case cited by the plaintiff in her brief, to establish this point. In that case, a scientist whose position was eliminated was transferred to a new position, which incurred a different title. He went from reporting to a vice president to a manager who he used to report to. And the court held that there was no adverse employment action where there was no evidence in a true diminishment of job responsibilities. As for the other evidence that Ms. Weber points to, moving her office closer to Christine Ader, or BCCing Fritz Lang and Paul Zarapata on communications, bless you, are also of no import, as it is clear from Mr. Zarapata's testimony that he wanted to be kept informed of Ms. Weber's progress, since he felt personally responsible for having asked Ms. Ader to take her as her subordinate. Moreover, it is very clear from the testimony from Zarapata as well as Ms. Engram that there is a unique matrix organization at Fermilab and that it is not uncommon to report to one person for duties and to the department head for personnel matters. The district court properly found that when Ms. Ader spent roughly 40% of her work week, she was not performing her job satisfactorily. Ms. Weber is hard-pressed to establish that this Internet activity was not done in conjunction with her business.
You know, it sounds like while she was in that CMMS project, she had virtually no supervision. Is there anything in the record about what her computer usage was like during that period?
No, there is not, Your Honor. Ms. Weber conflates the second and fourth prong in order to establish that she was performing her job satisfactorily and that a policy was discriminatorily applied to her. We would argue that this argument is, in fact, waived, since it was not presented before the district court. Instead, she argued that her past performance and the policy permitting incidental use of Internet usage for personal matters somehow established that she was performing her job satisfactorily. Nonetheless, this is a narrow exception, which is inapplicable here, since a tenet of these cases is that she must establish that a similarly situated comparator was somehow treated differently, which, as we have already explained, she cannot establish.
Let me get back to that. I think, if I recall correctly, you said there were two males that were discharged for similar reasons?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and that evidence was before the district court. Was it computer usage on their behalf, too?
No. In fact, there was only one policy violation associated with that for performing work on URA time in furtherance of their own personal business. As for the fact that one person who was viewing pornography on the Internet was not terminated, Ms. Engram testified that there were other people who had viewed pornography on the Internet and had been terminated. That can be found at pages 166 through 167 of her deposition. Moreover, Ms. Weber has not provided any information regarding the duration of the amount of time this person spent viewing porn, how often it happened, whether this was the only violation, or if there were any other mitigating circumstances surrounding it. Thus, he is not a true comparator.
That was good. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
How much time? 2.5 minutes, Mr. Baker.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the statement that the defendants presented two positions and thus cured any problem of demotion or adverse employment action, I would simply point out that there are cases in this circuit, and we've identified those in our brief, that discuss the fact that simply presenting two positions that don't change the monetary or compensation does not insulate the defendant from liability. And in fact, it must be considered whether under the circumstances those positions are in fact demotions. and we believe we've presented evidence of a demotion. With respect to the continued statement regarding the frequency of time on the Internet by Ms. Weber, again, the important inquiry is what was considered in terminating her, and was that a factor? There was no evidence that that was considered, so the fact that subsequently the company determines the amount of time does not mean that the decision to terminate her was justified. You must look at what the other gentlemen who are similarly situated, they violated the policy. The policy applies to all male employees, all employees, and there does not make any distinguishing factors about the disciplinary record, what their position is. It applies to all employees. We've pointed to evidence of other employees violating these policies who are not terminated. With respect to the statement that the complaints were not a protected, her complaint to the EEO was not a protected statement, we would simply submit that the question is, what did the defendant believe? Did the defendant believe her complaint was discriminatory? It did, and treated it as such. And I believe I'm out of time, Your Honor. We request that...
Still have about a minute left.
Okay. And with respect, finally, to the statement on about multiple hats, Ms. Ingram testified that she did treat workplace complaints different from complaints of discrimination. And she said that when she had a discrimination complaint, she would investigate it and open a file. In this case, she opened a file for a complaint regarding Mr. Augustine's performance review. She investigated by speaking to Mr. Zarapata and Mr. Augustine about it. She also said when it was a simple workplace complaint, she would refer the matter to Juanita Frazier. This matter was never referred to Juanita Frazier. It was treated as a claim of complaint of discrimination. Subsequent to that, the events we've discussed today were set in motion. There's a connection there, and we would ask that the court reverse the district court's ruling on summary judgment and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Mr. Baker, you accepted this case at the request of the court, did you not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the court thanks you for your representation of your client.
You're welcome. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.